Support for KSKA streaming comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, marking 47 years of commitment to operating the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
The state's going to do what the state's going to do, and it's going to be the legal fight of the century when we demand that they provide consideration for the taking.
Could the state take over Anchorage's port? A bill in the legislature would do just that. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, January 3rd. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, a planned drag story hour in Soldotna is canceled over safety concerns.
The reason that we're hosting this event was to create a joyous, wholesome, loving situation and safe place for queer kids.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly. The Alaska State Capitol received email bomb threats today, believed to be related to a rash of similar threats reported across the country, police and Capitol officials say. Juneau Police Department Deputy Chief Craig Campbell says his department is working with the FBI to assess the threat.
So it sounds like state capitals and universities and other large entities around the country are being flooded with emailed bomb threats today. We did get one at the state capitol.
The head of the agency overseeing Alaska State Capitol operations, Jessica Geary, said in an email that threatening messages were received in Legislative Information Office inboxes for Anchorage, Cordova, and Bethel. Geary says security officers searched the Capitol building and determined there was no active threat. She said she referred the matter to the FBI and local police. Juneau police said on social media that a downtown church also received a bomb threat today. Campbell says police do not believe there is a specific threat in Juneau, but they're working with the property owner to coordinate any necessary response. Campbell said he was not aware of any motive for the threat. NPR reported today that state capitol buildings in Georgia, Michigan, Mississippi, and several other states were evacuated after receiving similar threats. The FBI, in a statement to NPR, said it was, quote, aware of the numerous hoax incidents wherein a bomb threat at a state capitol building is made. The FBI statement said it, quote, had no information to indicate a specific and credible threat, and said the agency would continue to work with law enforcement agencies to collect information and respond. Meanwhile, with the holiday season wrapping up, local health officials encourage residents to incorporate some precautions for seasonal respiratory viruses. Bartlett Regional Hospital spokesperson Aaron Harden said that by taking care of individual health needs, people can help take care of the community's health as well.
It's a good reminder to just, you know, continue to take reasonable precautions, stay home when you're feeling sick, and keep up to date on your vaccines. And that really helps keep both the healthcare system and ourselves as healthy as possible.
Contagious viruses like COVID-19, the flu, and RSV continue to hit households in Alaska this holiday season. According to data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, more than 20 people were admitted to hospitals across the state with confirmed cases of COVID-19 last week.
We had an early rise of respiratory illnesses, particularly flu, in the community of Juneau that really mirrored what we kind of saw happening at the statewide level. But fortunately, that didn't translate to higher admissions here at the hospital.
Residents hoping to test for COVID-19 before gatherings may have to buy their own tests. The Juneau municipality stopped offering free tests to the public this summer. There is still a way to get tests for free, but it might take a little bit longer than a walk or drive to the local pharmacy. This fall, the federal government revived its program to offer free tests through the U.S. Postal Service. For residents looking for vaccines, Juneau Public Health Center nurse manager Allison Gotchlick says most pharmacies and healthcare providers have the most recent COVID-19, flu, and RSV vaccines. Last year, a powerful state senator from Bethel introduced a bill for the state to take over Anchorage's port. It's considered critical infrastructure because most of the physical stuff that enters Alaska goes through the port. Months have passed, and with lawmakers now headed back to Juneau for the next legislative session, Anchorage officials are still in the dark about why the lawmaker would pick this fight. Alaska Public Media's Jeremy Shea has more.
Thank you. Are the Senate bills for introduction?
Senate Bill number 150.
Last May, the state Senate spent about 14 seconds introducing a bill for a state takeover of Anchorage's port, potentially through eminent domain.
Senate Bill number 155 by the Senate Finance Committee, an act relating to the Port of Alaska, establishing the Port of Alaska Authority to manage and operate the Port of Alaska, and providing for an effective date.
Transportation and Finance.
That is the entirety of the public discussion the legislature has had about the bill. It was lawmakers' last day in regular session.
This was quite a shock.
I was also surprised.
We were as surprised as anybody when it floated up.
That was Anchorage Assembly Chair Chris Constant, the city's state lobbyist Wendy Chamberlain, and Port of Alaska spokesperson Jim Jaeger. And if you're wondering, yes, for now it's called the Port of Alaska, but the city of Anchorage owns and operates it. By weight, about half of all goods that enter the state arrive there. Assemblymember Meg Zalatel chairs a committee that oversees the port. She invited the bill's unofficial sponsor, Democratic Senator Lyman Hoffman of Bethel, to discuss the bill in her committee. In November, a Hoffman staffer told her in an email that they weren't ready. Staff in Hoffman's office said no one would be available for an interview for this story either, until the legislature goes back into session. Port Director Steve Rebuffo says his office also has not been contacted about the potential port takeover.
So far, we've not been asked one way or the other about how we feel about this. And because it falls into the policy category, and we don't make policy here, I'm not going to take a position on it. We're going to execute whatever the powers that be say is the best way ahead.
About 8 months later, and lawmakers are preparing to head back to Juneau for the session that begins January 16th. Anchorage's elected officials are concerned about a potential knockdown, drag-out fight. That includes Constant, the assembly chair.
The state's going to do what the state's going to do, and it's going to be the legal fight of the century when we demand that they provide consideration for the taking. If they, in fact, move on that goal, it'll be a very interesting fight.
The mayor's chief of staff, Mario Byrd, says the administration is also opposed to giving up the port.
That is not something that the taxpayers of Anchorage have expected for the last 50 or 60 years. And the administration's position is that the taxpayers should be respected.
The bill proposes creating a public corporation called the Port of Alaska Authority. It would be run by a board appointed by the governor, legislative leaders, and Anchorage's local elected officials. The bill also pays some special attention to an unresolved lawsuit between the city and a federal agency that was responsible for overseeing a botched port expansion project that began in the early 2000s. A trial court judge decided in 2022 that the feds owe the city more than $367 million. The feds appealed, and the parties are working on scheduling oral arguments in federal appeals court. The bill says the cash-strapped state would pick up the legal costs to continue fighting the case, as well as whatever money the feds end up paying the city. Meanwhile, Anchorage officials are left wondering what the bill means for the port's future. In Anchorage, I'm Jeremy Shea.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Fairbanks Middle Schoolers organize an event to help their homeless neighbors.
The amount of people who don't have what they need is insane. There's so much that could be done to help these people.
That's ahead. Stay with us. A Koyuk man is charged with fatally shooting his father Saturday in the village of roughly 300 people. According to a charging document, the defendant told Alaska State Troopers he'd been smoking marijuana and blacked out before the shooting. KNOM's Ava White reports.
According to an online trooper dispatch, 35-year-old Franklin Adams called emergency dispatchers at around 5:45 p.m. on December 30th to say that he had shot and killed his father, 74-year-old Dennis Adams, in their home. A trooper spokesperson says nobody else was in the home at the time. Two troopers arrived in Koyuk, about 130 miles east of Nome, shortly after. The charging document against Franklin says he told them he had been assaulted, by whom is unclear, then smoked some marijuana, which he thought must have been laced with some other drug, because it caused him to black out and fall on the floor. According to the charges, when he woke up, Franklin said that the floor and his tooth were both cracked and his lip was hurt. Franklin told the troopers that he grabbed a Remington shotgun from his bedroom. Franklin went into the living room where Dennis was, according to the charges, and told troopers, quote, when Dennis turned towards him, he saw in Dennis's eyes that it wasn't Dennis, end quote. Franklin told the troopers that he fired a shot at Dennis, but missed. The charges say Franklin told troopers he loaded another shell and shot Dennis in the chest, causing him to fall on the floor in Franklin's bedroom. Franklin said he couldn't get a third shell in the chamber, so he grabbed a different shotgun from the living room and went back to his bedroom. That's when Franklin dialed 911, saying he, quote, wasn't feeling himself. Franklin is now charged with first-degree murder. Court records showed Franklin Adams was held at Anvil Mountain Correctional Center in Nome as of Wednesday. His next court appearance is set for January 11th. Reporting from Nome, I'm Ava White.
Investigations continue in the case of a domestic violence suspect who died when being arrested by Fairbanks police last week. FPD Chief Ron Dupuy says officers responded to a Turner Street apartment late on December 28th after receiving a call from a man who said his son, 30-year-old Timothy McArdle Jr., had threatened him with a knife and was damaging his home. Chief Dupuy says officers tried to contact McArdle.
He came to the door a couple of times, but refused to come out, refused to talk to the officers. He could just be heard inside, breaking things, further destroying the apartment inside.
An FPD release says that included throwing items out of windows and breaking water pipes. Dupuy says police are required to arrest the suspect in domestic violence cases, and officers entered the apartment to do so. He says they attempted to use less than lethal force on McArdle, but citing the ongoing investigation, declined to be specific.
We have pepper spray, tasers, batons, beanbag rounds, pepper ball gun. We have a lot of different options that we can utilize in circumstances such as this.
But Dupuy says officers ultimately physically engaged McArdle, who fought them.
A hands-on circumstance, and got him handcuffed. Once they got him handcuffed, they found that he was unresponsive. They checked for a pulse and began CPR and called for EMS.
Dupuy says five officers were involved in the handcuffing, which took about 2 minutes. He says McArdle's father suspected his son was under the influence of drugs.
Told officers that he believed he'd been smoking methamphetamine.
Dupuy says police are awaiting the results of an autopsy by the state medical examiner.
That's going to be the key to this whole incident is, you know, what he actually died from.
Dupuy says preliminary autopsy results are expected by the end of the week. He says FPD and State Office of Special Prosecution investigators are meanwhile interviewing everyone that was involved and going over officer body camera video.
We will put together a press release and release part of the video.
The chief would not put a date on when that information will be made public and urged patience.
You know, we're still short staffed, so we have minimum number of officers working, minimum number of detectives. So we're doing the best we can, and we'll get results out as quick as we can.
Chief Dupuy says all the officers involved, some of whom suffered minor injuries, have been cleared to return to duty after taking 72 hours off as required following a fatal incident. Meanwhile, a former employee has been sentenced to jail time for stealing from the city of Anderson. According to an Alaska Department of Law release, 37-year-old Trista Nicole Jennings of Anderson pleaded guilty yesterday to first-degree theft for stealing over $140,000 from the city where she worked as clerk from 2018 until last spring. It says an investigation by Alaska State Troopers found that Jennings shifted funds from city to personal accounts. Anderson's mayor reported Jennings in May 2023, after which troopers say Jennings admitted to the theft during a search of her home that found recently purchased televisions, gaming systems, and computers. Under the terms of a plea agreement, Superior Court Judge Kirk Schwalm sentenced Jennings, who is already incarcerated, to 3 years in jail with 18 months suspended, plus 3 years probation. She also must pay back nearly $142,000 she stole from the city as restitution. A drag queen story hour event planned for the Soldotna Public Library this weekend has been postponed following online uproar about the event. KDLL's Riley Board has more.
The Storytime event was part of Soldotna Pride's winter celebration called Happy New Queer, scheduled for this coming Saturday. Other events include a drag trivia night at The Goods in Soldotna and karaoke at the Bow Bar in Kenai. The organization announced the postponement in a Facebook post Tuesday afternoon, citing online rhetoric and a need to protect participant safety.
The reason that we're hosting this event was to create a joyous, wholesome, loving situation and safe place for queer kids, which is something that I didn't have growing up and that a lot of kids in this community don't have.
Joe Spady is an organizer of Soldotna Pride and was one of the scheduled storytellers for the event. He says conversations on social media got more violent and led organizers to postpone. Much of the online discussion focused on one particular drag performer whose name included a sexual innuendo, listed at the bottom of the promotional poster with other drag queens. Spady says that performer was never going to be a part of the story hour and was set to participate in the adult-oriented event, also advertised on the poster. That performer has since pulled out of the event entirely because of online threats. Spady blamed poor poster design for the confusion, but said he's found online discussions to be hypocritical and reminiscent of the backlash to a Pride in the Park drag performance in 2022 that involved a viral video of a dancer.
The people who were most offended spread it the most, made sure that everyone saw those images that they found so offensive. They spread it as wide as possible in the same way that people who found her last name offensive have been spreading it more than anyone.
Upon complaints, Spady said the poster was edited. In a statement shared last Friday, Soldotna City Manager Jeanette Bauer clarified that the city and library were not hosting or sponsoring the Story Hour event, and that Soldotna Pride had simply rented a community room. Although the organization's flyer clarified this, Bauer says a cropped version had been circulated online. She clarified that the library frequently rents its rooms to community organizations and said, quote, "This practice allows our library to serve as a welcoming and inclusive space for a wide range of community activities. The city is committed to promoting diversity, inclusivity, and the free exchange of ideas within our community. We respect the rights of individuals and organizations to express themselves in a peaceful and lawful manner," end quote. Spady says a new date hasn't been set, but Soldotna Pride is planning to find a safe and inoffensive way to host the event. The trivia and karaoke events are still scheduled for Saturday, January 6th, at 5 and 8 p.m. respectively. In Kenai, I'm Riley Ward.
A polar bear found dead on Alaska's North Slope is the first of the species known to be killed by avian influenza, the Alaska Beacon reports. The highly pathogenic strain of the virus has been circulating among animal populations around the world. Alaska's Department of Environmental Conservation said the polar bear was found dead in October near Utqiagvik, the nation's northernmost community. After sampling the animal's body tissue, North Slope Borough wildlife managers confirmed that highly pathogenic avian influenza was the cause of death. That's according to Dr. Bob Gerlach, Alaska's state veterinarian, who says this is the first polar bear case reported anywhere in the world and has garnered attention from other Arctic nations. This was also the first Endangered Species Act listed animal in Alaska known to fall victim to the disease. Polar bears, which are dependent on sea ice that is diminishing because of climate change, were listed as threatened in 2008. While polar bears normally eat seals they hunt from the sea ice, Gerlach says it appears likely that this bear was scavenging on dead birds and ingested the influenza virus that way. In Alaska, three foxes, a black bear, and a brown bear have died from this strain of avian influenza. Gerlach says the spread of avian disease is pronounced in Alaska because of the mixing of migrating bird populations from Asia and the Americas. Meanwhile, 37 mushers are signed up to compete in the 35th running of the Copper Basin 300 Sled Dog Race. The roster includes defending and five-time race champion Nicholas Petit, 2022 CB300 winner Brent Sass, as well as 2016 champ Matt Hall. Other top mushers registered include Dallas Seavey, Ryan Reddington, and Jesse Holmes. The 2024 Copper Basin 300 is scheduled to start Saturday, January 13th at 11 a.m. It will take mushers on a 300-mile loop with checkpoints at Tulsana Lake Resort, Lake Louise Lodge, Sourdough Campground, Myers Lake Roadhouse, and the Red Eagle Lodge at Chistochina before finishing back in Glen Allen. According to the CB300 website, the amount of this year's race purse will be announced at a mushers meeting Friday, January 12th. Months after being found stranded in Kenai, a young otter pup is thriving in captivity in another part of the country. Those caring for the animal say they hope to introduce it to other captive sea otters this week. KDLL's Hunter Morrison spoke with zoologists about the otter's rehabilitation and has this story.
Last September, a motorist in Kenai spotted what they believed to be an injured cat on the side of the road, about a quarter mile from the Kenai River. The stranded animal was actually a 2-month-old otter pup from Cook Inlet, which had been separated from its mother. Biologists are unsure how long the pup was alone, but think tidal shifts are a contributing factor.
When we get a sea otter pup, they cannot be released back to the wild.
That's Jane Belovarik, wildlife response curator at the Alaska Sea Life Center in Seward. The stranded pup was brought to the facility, where it was rehabilitated.
They depend so much on their mother to learn how to hunt and forage and to, you know, be social, that that's just something we cannot replicate when it comes to these little guys.
The otter, named Denali, spent about a month and a half at the center. During this time, the pup was fed and groomed on a 24-hour basis, much like she would have under the care of her mother. Alongside Nuka, an otter pup that was rescued from an orca attack in Homer, Denali was transferred to the Minnesota Zoo outside of Minneapolis in mid-October. She was under 24-hour observation until a few weeks ago.
She is adjusted really well.
This is Tara Grace, zoologist for marine mammals at the Minnesota Zoo.
Initially, she kind of was keeping to herself. She would look over at the other otters, but now she's engaging them.
Grace took part in Denali's rehabilitation at the Sea Life Center. She also helped get the pup ready for transport, which occurred via airplane. Since arriving at the zoo, Grace says Denali has grown comfortable with her new environment. She also says the pup has grown curious and playful in her habitat.
She is a very smart girl. She picked up on all the animal training so quickly. She will find if you put something in there, she's going to find a way to get it apart if you don't do your job and make sure everything's secure.
The new environment has also allowed Denali and Nuka to bond with each other. Although they have not had direct contact, the pups enjoy engaging with each other via a see-through acrylic wall. Grace says the zoo hopes to introduce the two sometime this week.
How much they've grown and adjusted and at the Minnesota Zoo is amazing. They've taken leaps and bounds since they've been here, and we got to know them quite in depth and understand what their behavior is and how much they've grown.
Here's Jane Belovarik again.
By having an animal that can become an ambassador for the species, it really gives a face-to-face opportunity for visitors to be able to kind of understand how important these ecosystems are.
For updates and news regarding stranded marine animals being cared for, visit the Alaska Sea Life Center website. There, you can also find a hotline for reporting stranded animals. In Kenai, I'm Hunter Morrison.
Middle schoolers at F.E. Cochran Charter School in Fairbanks organized a hot food and warm clothing giveaway event at the turn of the year. They staged the event at the local tribal hall. As KUAC's Robin reports, it's become a winter tradition for the school.
The students spend weeks before the event gathering donations of clothing and crafting items for the winter giveaway. Seventh grader Silas Carlson says everything on the long tables in the tribal hall was organized by the students.
We have all sorts of things. We have food, drinks, toiletries, jackets, gloves, anything outdoorsy kind of. We have a whole bunch of snack products. We have stuff that will fill you up pretty quickly. Then we have toiletries down at the end of the table. And right now we're making coffee, water, all that stuff, making sure everything is prepared and ready to let people in.
The students spend about 3 days cooking for the event. They bring everything from the school to the tribal hall. Then they organize a serving line before opening the doors to visitors.
We can start making plates. How about that?
We worked together and we basically donated a bunch of things for this project. It's called the Effie Project.
Evangeline Titus says the event has taken the initials of the school's name, EFFIE. Effie, Families Feed Individuals Everywhere. Effie Cochran Charter School has only 145 students in 7th through 12th grades. They're a diverse group, the children of college professors and at least one of the homeless adults they served. Teacher Cheryl Maiorato made understanding homelessness part of the social studies unit. And in 2018, her class was inspired to invent the food and clothing giveaway.
What I want most of all is for them to actively engage in it. So many of them don't seem to get an opportunity with their family or class to go out and do something that's real.
The lesson was not lost on eighth graders Emily Victoria Lutkes and Victor Prax.
the amount of people who don't have what they need is insane. There's so much that could be done to help these people, and people just simply don't do it because they don't want to or don't have the resources to help.
This is more than just feeding people in need. It's like social science, kind of. We go out and we like see our community, we look at the demographic, and we try to think about like how we can better our society through this.
Seventh grader O.C. Sana McKenna-Massey absorbed one more part of the lesson.
It feels amazing that we are helping people in need.
In Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. Weird reports tonight from Eric Stone and Clarice Larson in Juneau, Jeremy Shea in Anchorage, Ava White in Nome, Dan Bross and Robin in Fairbanks, and Riley Board and Hunter Morrison in Kenai. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Wesley Early. Good night.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.